Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, and I am here for the hour, taking your calls live. 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. I do the show live, at least I try to do it, if not me, somebody, live every Wednesday evening, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, and we do it on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. Anyway, quickly, let me get back to do my disclaimer again. I noticed that somebody happened to pull out my disclaimer and put it up on YouTube as a separate clip. Yes, of course, I am trying to appease the regulators. So my disclaimer is the following. Any investment advice on this show, though I may not give any specific investment advice, but to the extent that anybody ultimately decides to adopt an investment strategy based on what I say on this show, based on the opinions that I express on this show, understand that it could be very risky and you could lose money doing that. I could be wrong on my forecasts. I could be wrong on my strategy. Of course, if I'm right and you don't take the proper precautions to protect yourself, then that too could end up being very risky. People who listen to this show have to decide for themselves what they want to do and take the appropriate action. And of course, I express my opinions on this show, my outlook for the future based on my own forecasts. They may be inaccurate, and of course, at points I sometimes talk about the fact that I got things right in the past, that I made some economic forecasts that happened to be true, and just because I got it right in the past, there's no reason to believe that I'm going to get it right in the future. In fact, the people who got it wrong in the past are just as likely to get it right now. Anyway, so that's my disclaimer. And, it's funny, too, because, as I'm watching a lot of the pundits on television who I remember debating and who were completely wrong, they're the ones that think the economy is recovering. They're convinced it's recovering. And the reason that they are convinced it's recovering is because they still don't understand the disease that they think we're recovering from. Because if they understood the disease, they would know that we're actually getting sicker. And it's amazing how wrong they're going to be. When the economy falls flat again, when we have a bigger downturn coming than the one that we just experienced. Now, I wonder how many times they could get it wrong before questioning the underlying assumptions upon which they forecast their models. I mean, there is so much bad thinking. I just did a radio show a couple of days ago, and the host of the show had Art Laffer on, and he questioned Art Laffer about the interview he did with me on the Kudlow show, where I predicted the collapse, and he said I was nuts, that, And, of course, instead of admitting that he got it wrong and I got it right, he's actually got the audacity to say with a straight face that he was right. And I, in fact, was the one who got it wrong. That's how clueless this guy is. First of all, he's saying that the interview is in 2006. And because it was done in 2006 and we didn't have a recession in his mind until 2008, that I was wrong. He said the economy has never been in better shape, and he's saying it was in great shape in 2008. He said monetary policy is spectacular, and he said it was spectacular. He said I was wrong because the crisis didn't happen until 2008, and that in 2006 the economy was in great shape, which shows you how little Art Laffer actually understands about the economy. I mean, first of all, the show took place in mid-2008, not early 2006, actually closer to the end of 2006. And the question was, will the U.S. economy be in recession next year, which was 2007? Now, I, of course, said that whether the recession began in 07 or 08 was immaterial, but that when it did begin, it would be measured in years, not quarters. And the recession officially started in the fourth quarter of 2007. So I was right. But even if you accept Art Laffer's idea that the recession didn't start in 2008, I said that I didn't know for sure if it would start in 07 or 08, but that it would start in one of those 2 years. Art Laffer, on the other hand, said I was nuts. He said there was nothing anywhere on the horizon that remotely looked like a severe recession. We might have a slowdown, maybe, but he said everything was great. Monetary policy was spectacular. The U.S. economy had never been in better shape. You know, what a crock. And to think that that was the case, the reason the economy fell apart in 2008 was because it was a house of cards. It wasn't a great economy like Art Laffer thought. I made the point that it was phony, that our prosperity was phony, that it was based on a housing bubble, that it was based on an overvalued stock market, that all we had was liabilities. And he said I was nuts. He wanted to bet me his reputation that I was completely wrong. So not only was Art Laffer wrong, hopelessly wrong on that 2006 show, but he's even more wrong now because even with the benefit of hindsight, he still doesn't know how wrong he was. It is completely incredible. And again, there are a lot of guys that are still on these shows, and I watch them from time to time, making these rosy forecasts, you know, talking like as if they actually know what they're talking about. And their memories are so short, they can't remember 2 years ago when they were saying the exact same thing 3 years ago when we were on the cusp of the biggest financial collapse that we've had thus far. Of course, the next one that's coming is going to be worse. You know, and they don't even remember how wrong they got it. You know, even Ben Bernanke even warned in recent testimony Congress that the deficits are unsustainable. Well, of course they're unsustainable, and he's helping to make it all possible. But, you know, when you hear people talk about unsustainable, very few people understand what that means. What that means is that, you know, we can't sell our bonds and that the whole thing's going to fall apart. What it means is that either we're going to have to slash spending across the board on government programs, we're going to have to default on the debt and tell people that we're not going to pay, or we're going to print tremendous amounts of money to fund our spending, and we're going to destroy the currency and unleash runaway inflation. And all this is coming soon. This is not way in the future. This is here right now. You know, people who think, you know, oh, we're sticking these debts on our children, the children aren't going to pay these debts. These debts will be long repudiated before our kids get old enough to have jobs. And we'll repudiate it through default or through inflation. Those are the only ways we can do it. But it's going to happen. Look, it's happening before our eyes. Look at the problems Greece is having. It's moving up the food chain. Now they're focusing on the UK, the United Kingdom, and their problems. And the pound is under pressure. It's not going to be long before their sights are set on the United States. We are the world's biggest offender here, right? All the other countries aren't going to be held to task for their out-of-control spending and their big deficits, and somehow the United States is going to get a pass, even though we're a bigger offender than everybody else? Not a chance. This all is going to unfold. It's unfolding before our eyes. You know, if you look at the recent strength in the price of gold, gold looks really strong to me. It's making, obviously, new record highs in terms of pound sterling, in terms of euro, but it's back on the rise in terms of dollars. Gold today, you know, back over 1,100 in the spot market. We're closing in on the high from January 11th, which is not too far above. We take that high out maybe this week. We'll be at a new high for the calendar year, challenging the all-time highs from December of 2009, I think soon. If we made a record high in pounds and in euros, We're going to make a record high in dollars, I think, soon. Meanwhile, look at oil. Oil is telling you that there's inflation, that money is losing value. Oil prices are back up at $81 a barrel. Oil is looking very strong to me. And, of course, other currencies that are commodity-based. The Canadian dollar is very close to a new 52-week high. Australian dollar, not too far behind. So those commodity-linked currencies are extremely strong. They're strong against the euro and the pound, obviously, as well. But they're strong against the dollar. I think something could happen almost any day. A big, big move up in gold, a big return down. You know, the dollar index has gotten up around the 81 level. You know, ran into a lot of resistance up above 80. We're right now bang on 80. We traded below 80 for a while late in the day today. We managed to close pretty much spot on the 80 level on the cash dollar index. But, you know, I think, you know, this could roll over and roll over quickly. You know, there was one senator, you know, Bunning, who, you know, was trying to stop the extension of unemployment benefits on the basis of the fact that we didn't have the money. Where was the money coming from to just pay more unemployment benefits? He wanted to force Congress to cut spending on something to make room for the unemployment. And, of course, Congress would have none of it. They didn't want any spending cuts. They just wanted to pay unemployment benefits whether we were broke or not. You know, and this is the attitude that has to end. You know, we're seeing this conflict right now in Greece between the public employees unions who refuse to accept cuts despite the fact that the country that's paying them is broke. The same thing is going to happen here. Look, the U.S. government is paying federal workers extraordinary, exorbitant wages that we can't afford. We're making payments on entitlements. We don't have the money. We are broke. We are going to have the same problems. Either the federal government is going to face up to the fact that it overpromised and can't deliver and has to cut spending, or it's going to pretend that it can keep its promises with printing press money, and then it's all going to hit the fan. And as I said just a few minutes ago, this is not going to play out in the future. This is playing out, I think, right now before our eyes. The whole process of the unraveling of this phony monetary system, our phony economy, began in 2008. That wasn't the end of the crisis. That was the beginning of the crisis. The lion's share of the crisis, as I've been saying, is still in front of us. It's got a long way to play out. People who think, you know, they keep talking about a recovery. We're not recovering. We haven't even begun to recover. We're getting sicker by the day. The problems are compounding. The government is doing everything possible to make the situation worse. In fact, if you wanted to script it, if you wanted to lay out a formula of what the government could do to completely destroy what's left of our economy, they are doing it exactly the way you would script it. To a T, they haven't missed the trick, including the fact that today Barack Obama again is going to try to slam and force feed his health care monstrosity through the Congress. Of course, you know, he threw the Republicans, or a couple of Republicans, a couple of meaningless bones, so he can get a few of these rhino Republicans to sign on to this thing and call it a bipartisan compromise. The only thing that's compromised in this bill is the Constitution, is common sense, is economics, it's the national interest. That's what's getting compromised. You know, this is a socialist program, pure and simple, that is going to drive the cost of health care even higher. The irony of the whole thing is the country might be broke before any of it actually sees the light of day. I mean, and when they write the history books about this particular time period, that irony will not be lost, that here we are on the verge of complete collapse, yet we thought we can afford this, right? That's how clueless our leaders are. When they should be slashing government spending because we're broke, they're about to vote for a huge increase in government spending when we're already spending 60 cents for every dollar we collect in taxes, and it's going out of control. You know, because this whole idea about ever increasing unemployment benefits, how long can we do that? Because the number of unemployed is going to keep growing, because the more the government spends, the weaker the economy gets, the more jobs they destroy. And now they have more people who are unemployed, so we want to spend even more money to give them benefits. And every time we do that, we send more people to the unemployment line. It is a self-perpetuating spiral that ends in complete disaster. And, you know, we have to understand that at the core of this system is a fraudulent monetary system. And people have to do something to protect themselves. Remember, you know, before 1971, you know, if somebody had, you know, $100,000 in the bank, right? If you had $100,000 in an American bank, what did you have? You had something real. You actually had close to 3,000 ounces of gold, 2,857 to be precise. You had something real. You actually had gold. What do you have now? You don't have anything. You got a piece of paper. What's it worth? Who knows? It's worth what you can get for it. And what if you can't get anything for it? Then it's not worth anything. So people have to understand, when you had a bank account, you know, years ago, you had real money. Now you've got nothing. If you want real money, you got to go out and buy it. You got to convert. So anyway, and if you have a broker at Europe Pacific Capital that you're working with, look, the brokers can also help you with your Perth Mint. Also on the stocks, I'm not as sure short term. I mean, the stocks can go either way. But I do think that commodity linked stocks, the gold stocks are trading very strong. I think other resource and inflation sensitive stocks should do well, even if the market rolls over. That's my feeling on it. And I do think the dollar is going to go down at this point. Either way, we've had this big run in the dollar. The dollar index has come all the way back above 80. I think we stopped out a lot of people. I think I've been saying that, you know, everybody was short the dollar for a while. It was a crowded trade. I still thought the dollar could break, even with all the excess baggage. But you know what? They've shaken it off. This rally up above 80, the problems in Greece, the problems in the UK, all the hot money is now short the euro. It's short the pound. It's not crowded on the dollar side anymore. I think the dollar, for that reason, is certainly ripe for a plunge now that a lot of that excess baggage has been jettisoned, and, in fact, much of it is now going the wrong way. And a lot of the people who shorted the euro are going to be forced, I think, to cover those shorts when they see that they've, in fact, shorted the wrong currency. Also, quickly before I take your calls, might as well mention that I did participate last night in the first televised quote-unquote debate among the three Republican candidates for Senate in Connecticut. The day before, on the Monday night, the two Democratic candidates squared off in their version of a debate. I think there was a little bit more debate going on between them. They actually had some back and forth. But I thought, in general, they presented themselves rather poorly in that debate, particularly Blumenthal, who's seen as this, you know, invincible guy. I think certainly his performance in the debate revealed that there are more than a few kinks in his armor. But anyway, the Republican version, there was very little actual debate. I mean, it's more like a joint press conference. And I didn't really like the format because, you know, you have a one-minute response and a one-minute rebuttal. And even though the rebuttal is, you know, you can challenge something that one of your opponents says, you know, if you really don't have any time to do that in a minute. And if you do, you can't say the things you want to say because you only got a minute to begin with. So everybody just kind of said what they wanted to say. I didn't really hear much that I disagreed with. The only thing that I really disagreed with, Linda McMahon said that, you know, that she, Rob Simmons has been attacking Linda McMahon because she supported TARP. And so the way she's trying to get around that now is by saying, well, she supported the original version of TARP, but she didn't support what's going on with the TARP now. Now, I opposed the original version of TARP as well, and I didn't have a chance really to explain on that debate why that version was just as bad. And I remember live, see, that the original idea behind the TARP was to buy up the toxic assets from the banks and then turn around later on and sell them for a profit so that, you know, the government could recoup the cost. And at the time, I said that was impossible because in order to buy those toxic assets, if they were going to buy them at what they're actually worth, the price would have to be so low that they would actually bankrupt all the institutions that the TARP was meant to help, that the only way to keep those institutions solvent was for the government to overpay for those troubled assets, to pay 90 cents or a dollar for assets that were worth 20 or 30 cents. And if the government did that, it was impossible to ever make a profit. So I said that it couldn't work, that it was impossible, that they couldn't do it, yet they passed it anyway. And, of course, I think Hank Paulson knew it was impossible. It was all bait and switch. He knew he wasn't going to do that, but he conned the senators and the congressmen into voting for it. And the minute he passed it, he went and used the money for things completely different than what he said he was going to use it for. And the fact that Linda McMahon would have fallen for that nonsense, I mean, that's the problem. See, none of our elected leaders know enough about economics and know enough about Wall Street to know that these guys are full of it, right? Henry Paulson could not have pulled the wool over my eyes. I'd have seen right through this charade, and I would have been able to explain to the other members of Congress why he was full of it and why the plan was impossible to be carried out. And maybe we could have stopped the TARP if I was in the Senate. But anyway, if you want to see this debate, it's on, I think, Fox or current Hartford Current. His website, current.com. I think the debate is there in its entirety. Also, I think it's all, I think there are versions on YouTube if you want to watch it. For what it's worth, from the feedback that I've seen and that I've read, I think I won the debate. Not, again, it wasn't that I won it because we didn't argue, but that I think that I presented myself the best. I think I was the most articulate or charismatic. I think I was more natural. I think Linda McMahon looked very scripted, very rehearsed in the things that she said. And I think Rob Simmons, you know, was a little bit more boring in his delivery. Of course, I was very natural. I mean, I don't look rehearsed because I'm not rehearsed. I mean, one of the interesting things was when we're waiting to be speaking, I'm looking next to me and Linda McMahon and Rob Simmons are there and they're writing notes. Linda immediately filled up this sheet of paper with lots of notes, two sides, two columns. She's writing everything she's been told to say, and she's writing it all down so she can remember what to say when she's speaking. And I didn't write down anything. I didn't have a single note written before the debate started. Now, I did write a couple of things during the debate in case I wanted to go back to it. So I ended up with four or five words on my sheet of paper. But they were writing novels. You know, they were writing as much as they could while they were going through the introduction. So I knew that they had rehearsed things and memorized things, and they wanted to make sure they said the right thing. So I definitely appear natural because a lot of times, you know, in fact, there was one point in the debate I actually had forgotten that there was a rebuttal coming up on the economy. I had another minute on the economy, and I was expecting them to ask me the question on national defense. So he said, Peter Schiff. And I just stood there. I didn't speak because I was waiting for him to ask me a question. And then when he said, your rebuttal, I was completely caught off guard, but I just immediately started talking on autopilot, even though I hadn't even collected my thoughts because I totally had missed where we were in the debate. But I don't know if anybody picked up on it. But I read a lot of the post-debate chatter, a lot of the blogs, a lot of the newspapers. I think pretty much everybody, even the liberal press, said that they thought that I won, that I made the best showing, that I was the most interesting guy. So I think that's good. I think my campaign needs that. I think it's going to help me. We're starting. I filmed my commercial finally. We had some delays because of the snow and the weather, but I shot my first commercial on Monday. They are editing it now, so it should be aired soon. We are making improvements to the website. They are underway. We're preparing for the next mailer, so I am very busy. But we can certainly use more volunteers, although we got a lot. We can certainly use more donations. So if you've donated, it's a great time to donate more at shiftforsenate.com. We can really use the money. We're spending more money now. This is a time where I really got to start running these ads and doing stuff so I can use all the money I can get. And, you know, if you haven't donated, great time to do it. And I think, you know, I think once the next polls come out, if the polls come out in a couple of weeks, based on the bump I'm going to get out of this debate, based on my ads running, I could poll quite a bit higher. Remember, last time it was 4 or 5%. I wouldn't be surprised to see me up at 10 or 15%, and then I can move up from there. I think both Linda and Rob, I think on this debate next to me, I would have, you know, they would have lost some points. I think people that were only supporting either of these candidates because they didn't know there was a third choice. I think now that they've seen that, they have one, I think I'm going to pick up a lot of support. That said, I think either of my opponents in this debate certainly, you know, said things that made a lot more sense than what either of the two Democrats said. Dude, one of these guys, Marv Alpert, or Alpert, who actually had a better showing, you know what he wants to do? His plan is he wants to spend another $1 trillion to create jobs. Another trillion. Where are we going to get that money? All right, so why not $2 trillion? Why not $10 trillion? I mean, this whole thing is nuts. Just spend money. We are broke. So we're just going to print money? And what is that going to do? Look at all the money. Look at the trillions we've already spent. And we're still losing jobs. You think another trillion is going to make any difference? It's just going to put us deeper into debt. It's going to make a bigger problem. At least none of my opponents said anything that crazy. And, of course, Dick Blumenthal actually had the nerve in his debate to say that he thought that his lawsuits, his excessive lawsuits, created jobs. Unbelievable. Unbelievable now that to say that his lawsuits created jobs. I mean, anything that they want to do now. They're actually trying to say Nancy Pelosi said that this health care bill is a jobs bill, that it creates jobs. I mean, any kind of cockamamie thing that they want to do, no matter how stupid, they now couch it in a jobs bill. It creates jobs. Like suing people creates jobs. It so obviously destroys jobs. I mean, one of the reasons that businesses don't want to hire people is because they're afraid of lawsuits if they have to fire them. I mean, lawsuits, legal costs run up unnecessarily the cost of doing business. And so we do less business. They make it harder, more costly to hire people. So we hire fewer people. Unbelievable what these guys will say. Anyway, I've been taking longer than I thought. Let me go to the phones quickly. David in Washington, go ahead.
Yeah, I have two questions, Peter. The first one, we heard a lot about China and the real estate bubble, and Mark Farber, either, I guess you're familiar with him, has gone negative on China. It seems to me that that it's not nearly the same situation that we had in this country, though, as the Chinese seem to be buying real estate, at least a lot of it, for an investment with their own cash, trying to protect against losing the value.
Yeah,
I don't think
it's a bubble, because remember, they're getting rid of dollars, which have no intrinsic value, and they're buying real estate, which has some intrinsic value. And they're not doing it with leverage. They're not using subprime interest-only adjustable rate mortgages. And, you know, if the real bubble in China is in U.S. treasuries. It's in U.S. dollars. That's what they got to get rid of. And to the extent that they use some of those dollars to buy a piece of real estate that actually has some value, they don't even care if they overpay. Because you know what? As long as you get rid of your dollars and get anything, it's better than holding onto them and rotting them down to the ground. You know, why go down with a ship? Get off.
Yeah. Well, that's what I kind of surmise. Even though the real estate may fall, it'd be much like a fall in the price of gold, a fall in the price of stocks, rather than a credit collapse. Even though, you know, their stimulus program promoted by the government was probably a negative thing for that economy. But the other question I had would be, what do you think of tips as far as...
I wouldn't touch tips. Remember, that's where you hire the fox to guard your hen house. This is the government saying, you can buy our bonds and trust us to tell you what inflation is, and then we'll protect you by pegging your interest payments to the CPI index. Oh, which, by the way, we happen to compute ourselves. You know, if you want an inflation hedge, don't buy any form of treasuries. Go buy the real or, you know, buy bonds denominated in foreign currencies like the Canadian dollar. You know, they actually have Canadian tips. They have their own version. So I think you can buy those. You know, you can talk to a Euro Pacific Capital broker. You know, we can help people buy foreign bonds, including foreign tips. You know, you need to talk to a broker, understand the risks there, understand the currency risks, understand default risk, all the risks inherent in buying, foreign debt. But, you know, weigh that against the risks of holding U.S. debt. I think that U.S. debt right now is extremely risky in any form. And I wouldn't be looking at buying anything that was dollar denominated, even if they do pretend to give you an inflation hedge.
So the tips, the U.S. Treasuries, even, I mean, they may well underreport inflation, but wouldn't the value of those go up
Not if they don't give you. Not if they're not giving. What if inflation is 20% and the government says it's 2%?
Yeah.
So you're going to still lose 18% that year. And so it's I don't trust it. I don't trust it. You know
what are the best for Australia? I've got some ETF type of Australia, Canada, and
as I said, do you have a brokerage account with Euro Pacific?
No, I don't right now.
Yeah, I mean, just so for the compliance aspects of it, I think the best thing is to have a phone conversation with one of the brokers who can talk to you more specifically about. The currencies that I like best and the best ways to get into those currencies, whether it's through bonds, whether it's through equities or money markets, what have you. But, I think that, the clock is ticking. It's a ticking time bomb on when the dollar explodes. And, it could be any day. I mean, it really could be. We are that close to this thing going off. And even if it takes a year or two, in the scheme of things, this is it. This is the ninth inning of the ball game. I don't know, how long it's going to take to play it out, but we are at the end of the game here.
Yeah, it seems to be. It's a sad situation. But, okay, well, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm hopeful that I can actually win this Senate seat in time, that it doesn't fall apart before I even have a chance to get there. Anyway, next up is Tom in Massachusetts.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. Wanted to report in here from a small manufacturing company in Massachusetts. Really tough times. We're muddling through. But one thing that we've done here is we really have restricted our credit, which we offer to customers. It used to be that new customers would show up and we'd offer them a line of credit. And one of the things that's gone on is we now say, we're not the bank. Put it on your credit card because we just can't take the risk of offering credit to somebody who's a new customer, a small order, and they just, don't pay it. The other thing I wanted to say here is one of the complications of having the government involved in manufacturing and in business is, they pick winners and losers. And just as an example, we're a wire control panel shop, and we strip a lot of wire. And our biggest competitor, which is up west of Boston, they just got $100,000 for a wire stripping machine from the government. And we're stuck here, and we're surviving with a 20-year-old wire stripping machine that we bought on eBay. We don't have political connections. We can't find a way to.
The politicians, if they want to pick winners and losers, they should get out of politics, go into the private sector, and pick them with their own money.
Right.
It's not up to. We don't want central government planning. We want resources allocated by individuals seeking profits, not by politicians seeking votes. It doesn't work. And what do you manufacture?
We make control panels from refrigerator size control panels that go in ice skating rinks all the way down to little 4-inch control panels that are used in.
Do you manufacture the from all of it, or do you have to import a lot of the components? Or
yeah, all the components are basically bought, and then we do assembly operations here. So we cut wire.
Yeah, that's the problem. Most of our manufacturers are in effect assemblers. All the other parts that are actually being manufactured that you're assembling, they're being manufactured outside the country.
That's right. And we
should be making all that stuff here. We used to.
One of my questions is, is from our perspective, globalization has been a disaster. And maybe that's just our perspective, but maybe you can talk a little bit about globalization in the manufacturing base.
It's not globalization. See, global trade benefits everybody. That hasn't been a disaster. What's been a disaster was our monetary and fiscal policies that have destroyed our ability to compete. And we've been able to survive because we've been able to subsist by borrowing money from abroad to import their products. But that's masked the underlying symptom of a collapsing economy. But it's not globalization that killed us. It's our own government. It's our own policies that destroyed our industries and made us uncompetitive. If it wasn't for globalization, we just would have collapsed sooner. But now we're going to do it in real style because globalization has enabled us to accumulate a massive amount of debt that we otherwise would not have been able to accumulate.
Right.
So, you know, we're really going to go out with a bang here.
Is the weak dollar part of the, you know, the balancing act that needs to take place in order for manufacturing in the United States to make economic sense?
Yeah, unfortunately, because we've, you know, we've screwed up so much, we've depleted so much of our savings and our capital is now, you know, antiquated, you know, we're going to have to compete on based on lower wages, you know, and one of the ways our wages are going to be lowered is because the dollar is going to lose value. I mean, that's just how it's going to work. But we have to do more than just have a lower currency. We're going to have to you know, repeal regulations and lower taxes because cheap labor is not it all by itself. I mean, you can have there's plenty of cheap labor in a lot of countries have cheap labor, but they're not manufacturing. You have to have other things. But yeah, unfortunately, you know, look at how many Americans are unemployed. How are they going to get jobs? We have so many unemployed Americans. What that means is that wages have to come down. It's unfortunate. But when you have a glut of unemployed people, it's because wages are too high. And part of the costs of wages is not simply what people earn, but what the government taxes and the mandates they put on you from hiring somebody. So one of the ways to get wages up or to prevent wages from falling is to cut the taxes and the regulations. So let's assume that in order to hire somebody and pay them $10 an hour, I actually have to spend another $4 an hour based on government rules and taxes and legal other things. So the true cost of hiring somebody is $14. Now, maybe at $14 an hour, I can't afford to hire anybody because the job isn't worth that. Maybe if at $11 an hour, I can afford to hire them. Well, the way to get to 11 is either we take $3 of taxes and mandates out of the equation, or the employee cuts his offers to work for $7 instead of 10. But either way, we have to reduce the cost of employment to find jobs for all the unemployed people, because that's why they're unemployed.
Right, right.
Because the government has made it so they can't get jobs.
Well, we've always tried to pay people around $14 to $15 an hour starting, just because that brings in reliable people. And, you know, living in Massachusetts, we want people that can, you know, earn a living. And the problem is, it just doesn't work anymore, especially with the health care. But I'll let you move on to somebody else. But I wanted to say thank you for running. I've given you some money, and I hope to give you a little bit more in the future. And very best of luck.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Next up is Johnny, a potential constituent of mine in Connecticut. Go ahead, Johnny.
Hi there, Peter. Thanks for taking my call. I and my wife and I are Euro-Pacific clients, but I am also a donor to your campaign. So, absolutely, I'm in full support.
Great, a twofer. I like that.
Right. What's the subset there? Now, I have to say that the two of my colleagues that I work with actually told me that they were fully behind you, and at least one is planning to give to your campaign now. The bad news from my standpoint is that I'm an independent, so I cannot vote in the Republican primary. But
you can still re-register Republican. There's time to do it.
That's true. Well, I mean,
it's worth it. Look, you can always switch back. But maybe I could bring you into the Republican Party. Maybe I could change the Republican Party so that you won't want to be independent anymore.
Well,
if I'm leading the Republican Party in Connecticut, don't you want to be a part of it?
Well, if you are leading it.
Go Republican and vote for me. And if the Republicans are not smart enough to elect me, then go back independent. But
no.
You got to get Republican to vote for me. And that goes for anybody who's a registered independent or registered libertarian. I'm your candidate. So re-register Republican because I'm running in the Republican primary.
But you got
and if enough people re-register Republican, that could be the difference that gives me the edge that gives me the nomination.
Well, the good news is that the two people that have converted to your campaign are both registered Republicans, and they do plan to vote for you. Like I said, one of them is actually going to be giving you money. Now, I had two questions. One is economics related, and the other is politics related.
Okay, try to make them quick. Let's take no more calls coming in, because I've only got about 17 minutes. I got four callers on hold. So anyway, okay. Let's try to take these last four. Go ahead.
I'll make it very quick then. You know, the inflation-deflation debate that's going on everywhere in the press, I'm wondering if this is a more nuanced way of looking at it, that inflation will occur with paper currency, but we might actually see deflation if you're looking at an ounce of gold.
That's exactly what I've been saying. I mean, that's exactly right. That's what I've been saying all along, that if you want to measure prices in terms of real money, they're going to be falling. If you want to measure them in terms of fiat currencies, they're going to be rising. So it all depends on your reference point.
Sure.
Yes, we have had a massive inflationary bubble. We are going to have a deflationary bust. There is no way out of it. But the government can prevent the deflation from happening in fiat currency by just creating enough of it. So because they can create an unlimited amount, and it has no intrinsic value anyway. So what happens is the paper money ends up losing value faster than stocks or real estate. And so it appears that prices are rising, even though when measured in real money, they're collapsing.
I mean, in the 1930s deflationary depression that we had, I mean, the dollar was still tied to gold.
Yes. And that was one of the reasons that it wasn't worse. It could have been a lot worse if we had the situation that exists today.
Sure. And
that was a salvation.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, that's certainly a much more nuanced type of a view, because I think a lot of other sort of economists out there are calling for a deflationary environment.
Because they don't understand economics and they don't understand money. You know, unfortunately, they're going to learn the hard way how wrong they are. Anyway,
now,
well, look, I appreciate your call. Appreciate your support. I hope you're registered Republican. Talk to as many people as you can, you know, in the state about me. Get one of my bumper stickers, you know, get a lawn sign.
Okay, I'm going to have to ask
my headquarters is in Milford, so if you go down there and meet the campaign staff.
Peter, I was wondering one thing, too. Do you agree with what Senator Bunning did?
Yeah, I think that was good. I think Bunning's a guy that's not even going for reelection. Maybe that's why he's doing the right thing. But, yeah, look, he said some good things when he's criticized Ben Bernanke. Look, and I oppose, you know, this whole idea that we can keep extending unemployment benefits indefinitely. We're extending the unemployment because people have less of an incentive to get a job when you're paying them not to work.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we don't even have the money. So he was right. If we're going to make the unemployment payments, then let's cut something else to pay for it. Let's make these politicians, if they really want to dole out these benefits, then find a way to pay for it. Don't just borrow it. But anyway, thanks for your call.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Next up is Eric from New York. You know, one more thing. I would rather give people on unemployment a lump sum payment right off the bat. And if they get a job quickly, they can keep the money. Because I don't want to just give people an incentive to postpone employment or not to take a job because they don't want to lose their benefits. Anyway, Eric, are you online?
Yes, I am, Peter.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm a campaign contributor and a regular listener of yours, and I have a question about something you had said. I have two quick questions. First one is something you said in Crash Proof, in your chapter on gold. You had said that that right now the gold miners, and probably silver miners too, aren't paying dividends, but you said that'll change. You said that'll change. And I'm correct me if I'm wrong, but did you say that in anticipation of the gold when the gold price took off?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the major gold companies are paying dividends, but they're very low. You know, they're
right,
less than 1%
peanuts.
Or lower 1%. But yeah, what my idea is as the price of gold, and I think those additional profits are going to cause the gold mining companies to start increasing their dividends. That's my forecast. It hasn't happened yet because even though gold prices have gone up, the cost of mining has gone up, although just to get some yield.
I'm in the same boat as you. I have several, lots of them actually, and I was just wondering, on what order are you thinking? Like 5%, 10%, 30%,
50%? Oh, I don't know. And of course, of course, the price of the stocks is going to be rising at the same time. So, you know, certainly if you bought your stocks cheap, you know, you could be getting huge dividends. But, you know, I don't expect the yields to be 10%, you know, based on the market price. But let's say they start yielding 2 or 3 or 4%. But at the same time, the prices have doubled or tripled, you know, based on somebody who got into the stocks cheaper, then the yields could be 10 or 20% a year based on what their actual cost basis is. But I don't expect them to pay a 10% yield, you know, because I expect as they increase their dividends, I expect the stock prices to also rise. And so that would bring down the yield for new buyers. But it certainly, you know, preserves good yields for the people who owned at lower prices.
Right,
anyway,
okay.
let me let you go and try to pick up another caller. Next caller is going to be Joe in Michigan.
Hey, Peter.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
I'm good. It's great to be on with you.
Thanks for calling in.
I wanted to ask you about the libertarian view on intellectual property rights, because from my perspective, this seems like a good intentions, and it's in the Constitution, but it just seems like government intervening both from manufacturers and consumers to inventors. And also, I know the idea behind real property rights is that you have a scarce resource that you need to exclude people from, or it'll be consumed too fast. But if the resource is ideas, those aren't scarce. So is there a need to protect them? And I was just wondering what thoughts you had on that.
Yeah, I certainly believe, and yes, the right, the idea of a patent is actually written into the Constitution. But I do believe that intellectual property, which would include, you know, copyrights for, you know, manuscripts, for books, you know, or inventions, needs to be protected. I mean, after all, let's assume that I write my book, Crash Proof. And if I can't protect it, somebody else that didn't have to write it, didn't have to spend all the time thinking up the ideas, can just run off books on his own, sell them for, you know, and a lot less money, preventing me from monetizing my hard work. Certainly with inventions, if I spend a lot of time, if I spend 10 or 20 years of my life to develop an invention, and then someone else can immediately sell the same invention without having to invest any of that time, and of course, you know, they can price it a lot lower than I did because they didn't have to recoup 20 years, let's say, that were spent research and development, and who knows how much that cost. You know, if you can't protect your invention, then you're not going to devote the resources to invent it. You're not going to make the sacrifice to invent something if you have no way to protect it. Now, I think the idea of a life of a patent, you know, it makes sense that you have a certain amount of time where you have an exclusive right to exclude other people from adopting that technology or copying you, but that after a number of years, that exclusive right runs out and it is available to everybody. And generally giving you a certain amount of time to have an exclusive is a valid compromise where you still provide incentives for people to make the sacrifices and to make the upfront investments necessary to develop a product or an idea. And you give them ample opportunity to reap the well-deserved rewards of their ideas or their inventions. But then you set in place a mechanism, you know, to be able to incorporate that into society without the need to compensate, you know, that person in perpetuity. And so I think it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, certainly, you know, I hope somebody comes up with a cure for cancer. You know, I really want someone to cure cancer. And, you know, the reason that people want to cure cancer is because they know if they do, they're going to make a lot of money. If they didn't think they could make a lot of money, then people wouldn't be devoting a lot of their resources into looking for a cure. You know, and that's, you know, that's just reality. And I, you know, I don't want to begrudge somebody making a profit if they can, you know, perform a service like developing a cure for cancer, you know. Anyway, hopefully that answers your question. Let me skip to the last caller of the show. It's going to be Jim from Pennsylvania.
Hello, Peter.
Hey, Jim.
Hey. Nice to talk to you. I was at CPAC, 2 weeks ago for that Freedom Watch. The Judge Napolitano had a live Freedom Watch. Boy, what a rowdy crowd that was. It was a lot of fun. I mean, just generally, all the campaign.
Were there any Schiff for Senate signs or T-shirts down
there? I was looking. I didn't see a lot of Schiff for Senate. I was there with the Campaign for Liberty. I was talking with a lot of people. I actually met one guy down in Trumbull, Connecticut.
Trumbull.
Young guy, on the county commission or something. We talked for a few minutes. Talked about your campaign. A lot of different things. Just a lot of fun. It was, good crowd. First time I'd ever been to a CPAC, but it was a great experience to get down there and people. It was just the Ron Paul people and the Fed people. I got hoarse yelling and the Fed. But my question, reading on the internet, I guess if you're a buyer of a stock from a naked short seller, the way in some cases it works, like you might pay and never get your stock, and like I guess even the enforcement and policing of it isn't in place to like actually settle that.
Well, you talk about naked short sales where people are shorting stocks that they don't have stocks that deliver in good form to the buyer. And they're supposed to deliver, and maybe there are some ways that the firms will hide the fact that you've never actually been delivered your shares, which if you're not taking delivery of a physical certificate, it might be hard for you to know that you don't actually have the shares in your account. And, of course, although the short seller still is going to be has to pay the dividend, but short selling is illegal. You're not supposed to short a stock that you haven't borrowed, because you need to have the shares to deliver to the buyer who bought those shares, who doesn't know that he's buying from a short seller. I mean, it's immaterial to you. When you go and buy stock, you don't know whether you're buying it from somebody who sold the stock short or somebody who actually owns it. You are getting delivered a certificate. Now, whether the seller is delivering you shares he owns or had to go out and borrow them, either way, you've got them. But if he can't deliver them because he sold it naked, that is a problem. It's not supposed to be happening, but we know that it does.
It happens, but I don't know, you go on the internet, you read a lot of different things. I saw that, the guy was saying that this is like almost not a common occurrence, but it's like almost like he called it like a gangsterism where people are doing it deliberately, getting the money, walking away from it, and like nothing. Enforcement ever comes on him.
The problem can come if you try to actually order out the certificates or move them from a margin account into a cash account, or do something to force them to try to, because then if they don't have the shares, they got to go out into the market. The naked short seller has to go out into the market and buy the shares. You get a short squeeze, and that can really shoot the price of the stock up. Anyway, well, thanks a lot for your call. I really appreciate it. Anyway, we're coming in the last few minutes here. Again, my observation of what's going on in the currency markets, the problems we're seeing with the sovereign debts, problems in Greece, problems in the UK, I can't help but think the U.S. is not far off, that these dominoes are falling one by one, and they are not going to miss us. We're not going to come out of this thing unscathed. And, just when everybody thinks that the coast is clear, that the problems are someplace else, they're not here, look out, because that's when it comes back to bite us. So watch this very carefully. Make sure you've got your ducks in a row. I think make sure you've got your gold and silver, you've got your foreign assets. This could be it really could be close to the time. And who knows? Hopefully it's not that, we need to have, our food supplies and things of that nature. I hope it doesn't fall apart that fast, but you never know. I mean, things could get pretty ugly pretty quick, depending on how rapidly the dollar falls and what our leaders, what more foolish policies they look to implement along the way to accelerate the decline and worsen the conditions in this country. It's very scary. And I mean, I'm running for Congress for a reason. I really would like to be a part of the solution to these problems, to help prevent them from getting as bad as they could. to help, you know, to win. You know, one of the things they mentioned on this debate was, you know, do I want to help, you know, do we want to be bipartisan? Well, I only want to be bipartisan if I can convince the other side to adopt my principles. We need to win the ideological battle here. I don't want to compromise. You know, I mean, it's this is a battle for the survival of the country. You know, the founding fathers, they didn't compromise with the British. You know, I'm not going to Congress to compromise. We've compromised our principles long enough. That's why the country is a mess. We need to win this ideological battle, and I need to convince Congress to adopt my philosophy, because my philosophy is the correct philosophy. It's the philosophy of our founding fathers. It's the philosophy of Adam Smith, of the Austrian economists. It's the only philosophy that works. It's the only philosophy that's been proven to work throughout history. And it's about time the other leaders of our country recognize that. And I'm going there to hold these guys accountable and to bring this change. Anyway, you can help me at www.shiftforsenate.com. Call up Euro Pacific Capital. Talk to my brokers. 800-727-7922. 800-727-7922. Make sure also to get your copy of Crash Proof 2.0. Buy several copies. Get some copies for your friends. We got to get these books out there in circulation. We got to educate the public and open up their eyes. Thanks again, everybody. This is Peter Schiff signing off. Until next week, Wednesday, 8 p.m., 5 p.m. Pacific, for Wall Street Unspun. Take care, everyone.